Session 627, November 13, 1972. The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth Book, by Jane Roberts. Beginning Chapter 6. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, Dictation, Chapter 6. The Body of Your Beliefs and the Power Structures of Beliefs. This is the heading. Quite literally, you live in the body of your beliefs. You perceive through the body of your beliefs. Your beliefs can increase your vision or diminish it. They can increase or diminish your hearing or any sense function. If, for example, you believe that after a certain time of life, hearing will fade, then so it will. You will begin to use the faculties less and less, unconsciously transfer your attention to the other senses to compensate, and rely less and less upon your ears until the functions themselves do atrophy, period. Functions in this particular regard are habits. You simply forget how to hear properly, following your belief. All of the minute manipulations necessary to hearing are unconsciously repressed. The actual physical deterioration, then, does indeed follow. The deterioration, however, does not occur first, but after. The same kind of development can occur in almost any physical category. Usually more than one belief is involved. Parallel with the belief that vision will fail, you will have the before-mentioned belief that hearing will dim. And these two ideas may be reinforced by a belief that age automatically makes you less a person, turning you into an individual who can no longer relate in the daily pattern of environment. The belief, you see, would work to ensure materialization of that state. On the other hand, you may believe that wisdom grows with age, that self-understanding brings a peace of mind not earlier known, that the keen mind is actually far better able to assess the environment, and that the physical senses are much more appreciative of all stimuli. And so those conditions will be physically met in your experience. The physical apparatus itself, following your beliefs, will continue in health. You must understand again that your ideas and thoughts do not exist as phantoms or shadow images without substance. They are electromagnetic realities. They affect your physical being, and they are automatically translated by your nervous system into the stuff of your flesh and of your experience. Your conscious mind is meant to assess and evaluate physical reality and to help you chart your course in the corporeal universe of which you are presently part. Other portions of your being, as mentioned, notes Rob in the last session, for example, rely upon you to do this. All energy at the inner self's disposal is then concentrated to bring about the results asked for by the conscious mind. Your effective power of action follows the lines of your beliefs. To believe in your own weakness is to deny yourself the power of action. To accept uncritically all beliefs that come to you is to open yourself to a barrage of conflicting data at best, in which the clear lines of action and power become blurred. Contradictory demands and assessments are then sent in to the inner self, which by various methods will try to tell you that something is wrong. Beliefs of like nature attract each other, for you are bound to look for consistencies in your behavior and experience. You must learn to deal with your own beliefs directly, or you will be forced to deal with them indirectly, by reacting to them quite without knowing it in your physical experience. When you rail against an unfavorable environment or a situation or condition, basically, and underline the following phrase, you are not acting independently, but almost blindly reacting. You are reacting to events that seem to happen to you and always in response to a situation. You act in an independent manner. You must begin to initiate action that you want to occur physically by creating it in your own being. This is done by combining belief, emotion, and imagination and forming them into the mental picture of the desired physical result. Of course, the wanted result is not yet physical, or you would not need to create it. So it does no good to say that your physical experience seems to contradict what you are trying to do. Because ideas and beliefs have this electromagnetic reality, then, constant interplay between those strongly contradictory beliefs can cause great power blocks, impeding the flow of inner energy outward. At times, a polarization can occur. Unassimilated beliefs, unexamined ideas, can seem to adopt a life of their own. These can effectively dominate certain areas of activity. You may take your break. Now, dictation. Not long ago, Rupert was presented with a demonstration embodying the nature and power of beliefs. He received a phone call from a man who lived in another state. There was a request for an interview. Without knowing why, Rupert felt an impulse to see the man and set up an appointment. The visitor arrived from the airport with his wife in tow. He was a study, a living example of the effects of conflicting unexamined beliefs, a fierce and yet agonized personification of what can happen when an individual allows his conscious mind to deny its responsibilities, when an individual becomes afraid of his own consciousness. Here was a young man whose beliefs were alive with their own life while he was relatively powerless. No effort had been made to reconcile directly opposing beliefs until the personality itself was quite literally polarized. You were faced with what could be called a classic instance of secondary personality. I am discussing it here because it so beautifully illustrates the nature and power of beliefs and the conflicts that can arise when an individual does not accept responsibility for his own thoughts. This is not the usual case, but to some extent or another, such a division occurs physically or mentally when the contents of the conscious mind are not examined. Entering, the man bristled with belligerence and hostility. Having requested help, he then hated himself for the weakness that he believed caused such a need. He glowered at our friend Rupert with great vehemence, projecting all of the energy at his command to show that he would not be cowed, and that if anyone took over the situation, he would be the one to do so. He spoke of another personality far more powerful than he, though, he said, he could force a roomful of 150 people to follow his commands. The other personality, however, originated in another galaxy, and came as a friend to help and protect him. At his behest, he said, this invisible friend killed a lawyer. The lawyer not only did not understand the condition, according to the story, but hurt the feelings of the man under discussion. We will call the man Augustus. Take a break for Rupert. Rob notes Jane had begun coughing intermittently after last break. Now she coughed so steadily that Seth interrupted the delivery, which is a pretty rare occurrence. While Jane rested, I suggested that if Seth returned, it would be better if he discussed the reasons behind her coughing. This was done. Surprisingly, the material received ran into several pages. The session ended at 11:43. Session 628, November 15, 1972. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts, continuing in Chapter 5. Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Seth. Seth, and we will resume dictation. To begin with, Augustus was brought up to believe that the inner self was dangerous, that individuals reacted because of inner conflicts over which they had little conscious control. He believed that the individual personality was relatively powerless to understand itself and that it stood precariously alone and undefended, as a chasm of evil beneath and with an unattainable, cold, just, but not compassionate good, with a capital G, above. He felt bewildered in a world of opposites. Conflicting beliefs were uncritically accepted. The conscious mind will always attempt to make sense out of its beliefs, to form them into patterns and consequences. It will usually originate ideas in as rational a way as possible, and dispense with those that seemed to contradict the overall system of its beliefs. Augustus had been taught to fear his own thoughts, to avoid self-examination. Beliefs or ideas that frightened him were not faced, therefore, but initially shoved into corners of the conscious mind, where they lay relatively harmless in the beginning. As time went on, the number of unexamined, frightening events began to accumulate. Ideas and beliefs do feed upon themselves. There is within them a built-in impetus toward growth, development, and fulfillment. Over the years, two opposing systems of beliefs built up strongly, vying for Augustus's attention. He believed that he was utterly powerless as an individual, that despite all his efforts, he would come to nothing, go unnoticed. He felt completely unloved. He did not feel worthy of love. At the same time, he let his conscious mind wander, and to compensate, saw himself as all-powerful, contemptuous of his fellow human beings, and able to work greater vengeance upon them for their misunderstanding of him. In this line of beliefs, he was able to do anything, cure mankind's ills if he chose, or withhold such knowledge from the world to punish it, period. Now, all of these ideas were quite conscious, but he held each group separately. The conscious mind again tries to obtain overall integrity and unity, lining up its beliefs into some kind of consistent system. When opposing beliefs that directly contradict each other are held for any length of time, and little attempt is made to reconcile them, then a battle begins within the conscious mind itself. Since it is the beliefs of the conscious mind that regulate the involuntary bodily motions and the entire physical system, then contradictory beliefs obviously set up adverse physical reactions and imbalances. Before Augustus's opposing beliefs lined themselves up into separate camps, so to speak, the body was in continual turmoil. Contradictory messages were constantly sent to the muscular system and the heart. The hormonal system teetered. Even his physical temperature varied rather drastically. Because like ideas do attract like, both electromagnetically and emotionally, the conscious mind found itself with two complete contradictory systems of belief and two self-images. To protect the integrity of the physical structure, Augustus's conscious mind neatly divided itself up. No longer were the minute-to-minute messages to the body scrambled. The part of Augustus who felt powerful and alien became personified. When Augustus felt threatened, then, the conscious mind switched over, accepting as operating procedure the system of beliefs in which Augustus saw himself as all-powerful, secure, but as alien. This part of his beliefs, therefore, and this particular self-image, took over his conscious mind and became what we will call here Augustus II. When Augustus II assumed leadership, then the entire physical body itself was not only strong and powerful, but capable of physical feats far surpassing those of Augustus I. Augustus II, you see, believes that his body is nearly invincible, and following this belief, the body does perform much better. Augustus II believes that he is an alien. In this case, the rationale, because there must be one, is that he is a being from another planet, in fact, from another galaxy. His purpose in this case is quite clear and simple. He is to help Augustus I to use his power over the latter's behalf, rewarding his friends and terrifying his enemies. Augustus I quite deeply believes he needs this kind of help. Now, this is a split of a conscious mind. It does not originate within the inner self. When Augustus II takes over, he is quite conscious. He simply views physical reality through an undeviating system of beliefs. The messages sent to the body are not in the least contradictory. The body is under excellent control. Augustus I's methods, of course, are a direct result of the ideas he was entertaining. It was this unceasing swing from high states of exaltation and power to low ones of powerlessness and depression that the body could not tolerate, because of the vast alterations entailed. For the greater periods of time, Augustus I predominates. Since his ideas of worthlessness, in your terms, were adopted earlier, and worse, are only reinforced by the constant between him and Augustus II, Augustus II comes on sometimes for as long as a week at a time. He does all the things and says all the things that Augustus I would dearly love to say and do, and with only certain safeguards. Augustus I, however, is not literally unconscious during this time, but quite aware of the vicarious activities and fulfillments. Again, it is a game of hide-and-seek, in which the so-called unconscious mind is relatively innocent. Augustus, too, can therefore rant and rave, lie and cheat, assert himself, show his contempt for his fellows, and absolve Augustus I of any responsibility. You may take your break, and we will continue. Now, there is nothing evil in the nature of Augustus II. In spiritualistic circles, however, he would most certainly be interpreted as an evil spirit or guide. His nature is protective. His basic ideas and beliefs that have been personified into his being, that became his being, were forced to protect Augustus I from the destructive ideas given to him in his childhood, to combat the beliefs in powerlessness and futility. To that degree, they were added into the original ideas, but still at an early age, so it was from the child's concept of a powerful being that Augustus II sprang. The greater the feelings of weakness, then, the greater the compensating feelings of power and strength, but again with no attempt at conscious reconciliation. Augustus's mother noted only that her son seemed highly changeable. Augustus II did not present himself as, obviously, another personality until after Augustus's marriage, when the demands of fatherhood and making a living were placed upon him. He could not cope. His beliefs in his unworthiness prevented him from using his abilities or even pursuing a course of effective action with any persistence. It was then that August II began to assert himself, and to Augustus's wife. In his own way, Augustus II would prove to her that he was married to quite an unusual, powerful man, a paragon of virility and strength. But to do so, Augustus I must appear as Augustus II to her. This continued for some time. Augustus I would first develop a splitting headache. Then his alien from outer space would arrive, the commanding male that Augustus I was not. Here, however, the deception brought about certain difficulties. Not only was Augustus II more sexually promiscuous, but by contrast, Augustus I seemed very pallid indeed. Augustus II was originally intended to help Augustus I. It's true that the exotic conditions spilled over, casting some glamour on Augustus I when Augustus II left for a time, but the contrast was too blatant, too out in the open. Augustus I, still the primary personality, became even more frightened. He knew that, gradually, Augustus II was outliving his purpose, showing him up, and had to go. In fact, once Augustus II obviously took over the body of Augustus I, it was all out in the open in the family. The wife began to take notes of what was done and said. When these events were repeated to Augustus I later, the lying and cheating was evident. So was the infantile nature of the personality. Yet Augustus II purported to be all-wise from a galaxy far surpassing Earth in every category of endeavor. And here he was making predictions that never happened, and boasting, and lying like a trooper. The beliefs whose energy generated this alternate self-image then appeared in the daylight, acting out their natural results in physical reality. Augustus I, now in manhood, was forced to perceive the nature of those beliefs to some extent, yet when he was here visiting Rupert, he still would not examine them. Augustus II has not taken over for 2.5 months. Augustus is in a dilemma, for he still holds intact the beliefs in his own powerlessness, and the contradictory beliefs of omnipotence are not now being expressed through Augustus II. yet expressed they will be. And so in the interview, Augustus I, who we will now simply call Augustus, at one moment came through with his gigantic belligerence, staring at Rupert and telling him that he could annihilate anyone who hurt him. In the next moment, the great plea for help would surface, the love of his wife and child. In one sentence, Augustus would make a statement, and 10 minutes later make it clear with another remark that the first fact had not been true. Here the polarity between Augustus I and Augustus II had dissolved, so that the two opposing systems of belief operated alongside each other. Still, Augustus would not examine his own words, his own thoughts, or see the contradictions so obvious to others. The nature and importance of belief appeared so eloquently that Rupert was astounded, and found himself forced into some complicated psychological footwork. The two personalities were no longer separate, but merging. Augustus said, "My friend killed a neighbor of mine who was against me by giving him pneumonia. He looks out for me. Another friend has ulcers." And Augustus told Rupert that after he touched his neighbor, the ulcer seemed to have been healed. So he said, "I would like to know how much of this great ability belongs to me." And looking briefly away, "Perhaps I do not need my friend to protect me at all." Now this was definitely to the good, in that Augustus was beginning to feel that perhaps he was not powerless. His own personality, however, is left to handle the definitely unsavory characteristics of an Augustus II who is no longer personified. He is left with the questions. If I am so powerful, how is it that I am so weak and cannot even support my family? If I am so great, why cannot I effectively use my energy? For the body of Augustus is once again under the sway of beliefs about himself that are highly contradictory. Before he was spiritually powerful when he was Augustus II and weak when he was Augustus I. Now, as Augustus, he is alternately strong and weak, and the body stresses are apparent. As Augustus II, he could stay up night and day and perform physical tasks quite difficult for the normal human being to do, for he operated under the indivisible idea of power and strength. It has taken some courage for him to let Augustus II vanish, because the neat division of beliefs no longer exists. However, he will seem even more difficult to his wife since the characteristics of Augustus II now bleed into his own. He will lie, for example, where before only Augustus II lied. Here then is a case where directly opposing beliefs dominated the conscious mind at various times, each operating the body in its own manner. Physically, the body has the same capacity for strength, regardless of which group of ideas were dominant. But practically speaking, Augustus I was incapable of performing the feats of Augustus II. Augustus II once leaped from a second-story window to the ground in anger and without injury, a highly unusual feat. Augustus, however, is so exhausted that he can barely get through a normal day. You had a situation in which an individual, through beliefs, put his power and energy literally beside himself. He could use it only when he switched beliefs completely. It was only because the childlike characteristics of Augustus II finally appeared so blatantly that Augustus II had to be dispensed with. Augustus's wife made the difference, for it was obvious that she did not have the same opinion of his friend that her husband had. Her beliefs then became the new foundation, the one point of change that allowed Augustus to view his alternate self-image with any kind of detachment at all. "You may take your alternate break," Rob notes humorously. Rob notes, "Jane remembered nothing of what Seth had said, but as soon as she came out of trance, which was quickly as usual, she told me, 'I can tell that Seth's got more on that right there, all ready and waiting. In between sessions, I don't feel aware of that usually, though I dream about it sometimes. This was the end of book work for the evening. After break, Seth came through with 2 pages about a matter I'd brought up earlier tonight. Thus, the recorded session ended at 11:51. The session resumed, however, after I had put my notebook aside. During a spontaneous exchange, Seth delivered some insights concerning his own origins and creative aspects and why Jane's personality would make the emergence of a Seth possible. There was more. I didn't write down what he said, and as usual ended up wishing I had. Perhaps we'll take the time to recoup it during a session. I've always found that the material seems to fly away unless it is recorded at once in some fashion. One of the reasons for this, I've often thought, is because Jane isn't the only one who's in a trance during a session. The receiver, myself, for instance, is too, in his or her own way. When the connections between Seth and his audience are broken, the material is to some degree left behind in that common meeting area. Session 629, November 29, 1972. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts, continuing in Chapter 5. Seth, there is no real adequate framework in your society in which people like Augustus can be treated with any effectiveness. An analyst might consider Augustus as schizophrenic and label him neatly, but such terms are basically meaningless. If the analyst, over a period of time, should convince Augustus that his condition in the present resulted from some specific inherited event in the past, and if the analyst was an intuitive and understanding man, then Augustus might change his beliefs enough so that some kind of cure was worked. He would then conveniently remember such an event and display the expected emotions as he re-experienced it. Unfortunately, in his present state, powerless as it were without Augustus too, he might also simply call on his alter ego to show the good doctor that he was no one to trifle with. Then there would be the matter of helping Augustus to face the implications of his other self's behavior in such a way that he could accept it as a portion of his whole identity. When Augustus too was in control of the body, the chemical makeup varied considerably. It showed significant differences over Augustus's usual hormonal status. The chemical changes were caused by the transition of beliefs that operated, and not the other way around. Rob notes, pause 10:08. See the material on hormones and beliefs in the 621st session of Chapter 4. Seth, if chemical alterations were made in Augustus II, he would return to the Augustus I personality. But the change would be artificial, not permanent, and possibly quite dangerous. The chemically inhibited tendencies would to some extent be forcefully blanketed through medication. The problem would remain, though, and it is quite possible that overt suicidal tendencies could result, or more insidious hidden suicidal inclinations where vital organs would be attacked. Sometimes such cases are handled within another framework, in which Augustus would be considered possessed by an independent evil entity whenever Augustus II took over. Now again, if Augustus somehow changed his beliefs, it is possible that even within that framework, some kind of cure would be effected. But at the same time, the dangers and difficulties would make such a cure relatively impossible. If a practitioner who believed that Augustus was possessed then convinced Augustus of that fact, their joint charged beliefs might possibly work for a while. Convincing Augustus that he was under the domination of an evil entity would be a step one. Step two, getting rid of the intruder, could at least follow. The trouble is that, working within that framework, the self structure is further weakened, for the normally repressed characteristics of Augustus II are forever denied. Augustus must then always be good, and yet he would always feel vulnerable to another such invasion of evil. The same results as those given could be possible. The growth of suicidal tendencies or other self-destructive behavior. You may take your break. Rob, when all this started in late 1963, About speaking in trance, Jane said, I used to feel that there was just one word available at a time, with nothing before it or after it. But now I sense whole blocks of material there, just waiting to be given. Like the stuff on the speakers tonight, earlier. It's like that more and more often. Before the session began, Jane had, again, been aware of several channels of information available for Seth. Resuming at 10:45. Seth. Dictation. Luckily, the human mind and body are far more flexible, durable, and creative than ever given credit for. Many cases like Augustus's never come to light. The individuals involved cure themselves. Sometimes this is done when a person chooses to undergo a traumatic experience. Often, one part of the personality can plan this quite deliberately, while the other portion closes its eyes. These events can seem to be disasters or near disasters, and yet they can sufficiently mobilize the entire personality for survival's sake. In a moment of high critical tension, the personality may put itself together again. Such critical uniting episodes usually do not involve long sickness, though they may, but instead events such as bad accidents. The difficulty may be exteriorized as a broken limb, for example, instead of a broken self. And as the body is repaired, the necessary assimilation of beliefs take place. There are various kinds and stages in such cases. Each individual is unique. Sometimes the framework includes another method of cure, in which portions of each conflicting side of the personality break off to form a clearer psychological structure, which can communicate with the other two, act as a referee, and reconcile the opposing beliefs held by each. This is done many times without the main personality realizing what is going on. On occasion, automatic writing is utilized, or the Ouija board. Both are methods to uncover invisible conscious beliefs that are accepted by you consciously at any given time, say, and deliberately ignored at another given time. When people using such methods are told that their writing comes through from a demon or the devil or an evil spirit, then those invisible beliefs are shoved farther away. Any search into the mind becomes frightening and dangerous, since it might lead to further such invasion. Now, such invasion is usually the sudden appearance of previously unacceptable beliefs, quite conscious but invisible, tucked away. Then they suddenly appear as alien. In most instances, the possession concept makes it all the more upsetting. Easier to face, often, is the idea that the responsibility of such ideas must belong to another entity or being. In all cases of this nature involving Augustus-type episodes, the problem is one of unassimilated beliefs. Instead of such comparatively drastic behavior, however, such beliefs can be expressed through various parts of the body. Unfortunately, a system of medicine that largely deals with symptoms only encourages a patient to project such beliefs on new organs, for instance, after already sacrificing others in operations. The solutions lie in the conscious mind. I cannot emphasize this too strongly, and in those beliefs that you accept about the nature of reality, and specifically about the nature of your being. While the most basic work must be done by the individual, help is always available from a variety of sources, both within and without. You will literally interpret and use almost any data that comes to you as helpful, and it will be highly effective, unless your beliefs lead you to think, perhaps, that everyone is against you, or that you are beyond help, or that you do not deserve it. Other such ideas can also close you off from help, of course, but you will instinctively look for it and use it when possible. You may take a break or end the session as you prefer. Rob notes, we'll take a break. 11:15. I chose a break in order to see if Jane still wanted me to ask Seth about the ideas she talked about before the session. She had been tired earlier, but had revived considerably by now. Nevertheless, she decided to forego the question and end the session. Session 630, December 11, 1972. Rob's notes. Jane and I set for the session at about 9:15. At 9:25, she abruptly told me that she'd just received the title of a book I am to write, Through My Eyes. She was very surprised, and so was I. At first, Jane said, she interpreted her information from Seth to mean that I would be writing a chapter with that title for one of her own books. But then she quickly realized that this is to be a work of my own. It's supposed to express my views of the Seth experience and how it has influenced or changed my ideas on art, life, and so forth. Then, as Jane told me about all of this, she announced that Seth was coming through right away. A most unusual procedure as far as our regular sessions are concerned. She took off her glasses. Seth. Now, the book title should be Through My Eyes, and it should be your own work, covering in your own way many important areas. You have writing ability, as you know. The book should cover your version of our joint experience, your own philosophical explanation of it, the questions it arouses within your own mind, your observations of Rupert as Jane, and in our trance states. Other portions should explain your own ideas concerning creativity as you feel it in yourself, the differences and similarities between your experience when you paint a picture from usual inspiration and when, first of all, you perceive the psychic impression that leads to a painting. Such illustrations from an initial sketch to a completed painting should be included. Give some thought to experimentation, observing the nature of color in usual consciousness and in altered states. Pay attention to color in your dreams also. You should go into your own ideas about the people you paint and why, being fascinated with portraits. You often do not use models. The book can include some of the material I have given you on art through various channels and how you have applied it. This work can be followed by one utilizing sessions concerned with art mainly, but covering some other artistic areas as well, such as the nature and origin of inspirations. I have given you an outline that I am sure you can follow. The book should be fun to write besides, and combining your writing and painting abilities. The title is a good one, and the book will sell. You will be able to get a contract on it with advance, and writing it will also serve as a spurt for your painting. I'm being tricky here. Rob, are you? I tried to bait Seth a little here. Seth, I am indeed, for this will short-circuit some of your hang-ups as far as painting is concerned, and will lead to new spontaneous painting power, humorously, notes Rob. You will also consider it a work of merit, and you will be doing your own thing with your experience. I know that the impetus alone will, quite slyly and automatically, produce some excellent paintings. You will want to use them. I will not tell you in what particular way this sneaks by some of your problems now, or which ones are involved. I suggest that you do up a prospectus, an outline, and some few beginning pages, say a chapter or so. Now, we will have a break, and that is my little surprise for both of you. Rob, I'll say thank you. I'm so surprised. I haven't even put my glasses back on yet, Jane exclaimed after she'd come out of trance. Neither of us have been thinking of such a project, which isn't to say the idea of my doing a book involving Seth, at least in part, hasn't occurred to me occasionally. I'm really surprised when something like this happens to me in a session, Jane said. It's so different from what I've been thinking about or doing. I can see a section of the book right now with your illustrations. I can see Seth's portrait on the cover page. She pointed over her right shoulder to where the painting, which is reproduced in the Seth material, hangs on our living room wall just in back of her rocker. Resume in the same active manner at 9:58. Seth. Now, this book will be a good advertisement for the later book, which I will do. And if you insert what I have told you in the book I am doing now, people will already begin to look forward to your book. Rob notes, that's pretty crafty. Seth, so included in The Nature of Personal Reality, for it is the birth of the book of your personal reality. I had several things in mind this evening. Some of Rupert's questions will be answered in our next chapter, which we will begin. Then I will have some other personal comment.